You know, our society really loves a good speech. We love a good motivational kind of speech. We love to be kind of fired up, you know. Whether we see it in a movie, and somebody's firing up the crowd for a battle, you know. There's this line of warriors, and this one warrior is running back and forth and really, you know, charging everyone up. Or if it's a motivational speech from, you know, from a politician or someone else, a State of the Union, some of those kind of things. We love to fall in line behind. We're energized by those things. And it's funny, you know, but I tend to think that in our society, they end up being a lot like what Tracy Jordan from 30 Rock says. When he was giving the commencement speech at a college, and he said, "Just be yourself, and I promise that every single one of you will one day be president." And I really think that that's what ends up happening in our motivational speeches. And you may even come in here and think this is one of those things. And in this passage that we're talking about tonight is probably one, even if you've never even cracked open a Bible and wouldn't even claim that you're a Christian, you've probably heard about the story of David and Goliath. And one of the biggest problems that we have when we talk about a story like David and Goliath is to think of it like a motivational speech. It's been preached that way. It's been taught that way. It's a good old, good for you story. You always hear it, you know, in maybe after a football game when an inadequate small team beats a larger, stronger team. Or in other ways. You hear it all the time. It's constantly used in our society. But it's nothing like a good motivational speech. That's not what it's about. It's not meant to just say, "Hey, go beat up the giants in your life. You can do it." Because that's what we tend to think when we read it. And it's not just a moralistic thing of, if you just get the courage to do it, then you can do anything. It's so much deeper than that. And in fact, before we read this, I love how it's kind of drawn apart. We see actually three versions of courage here. We see Saul's version of courage, we see Goliath's version of courage, and we see David's. So we see Saul, Goliath, and David's. And those are the ones I want you to look at as we read through this passage together about what does it mean to have courage? What does it mean? It says in verse 32, "And David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth.' But David said to Saul, 'Your servant used to keep the sheep for his father, and when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he rose against me, I caught him by the beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God.' And David said, 'The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'Go, and the Lord will be with you.' Then he took his staff in his hand and chose five smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, 'Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?' And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, 'Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field.' And then David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the hosts of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword or spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hand. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Imagine this as we look at this and thinking about Israel and Saul here and their view of courage. Because the first thing you need to understand is that Israel was terrified. Saul and Israel were absolutely terrified. And the way that they viewed this was out of self-protection. That was their view of courage here. Self-protection. Imagine that there's an enormous valley, and on one side is a mountain lined with Israel, and on the other side is another mountain lined with the Philistines. And this is the picture that we have. And day after day, they would come and they would war here. But then this champion arose named Goliath, who came down from the mountain into the valley and shouted up to the other side to Israel. This huge, enormous man. And we're actually, it's interesting here, I didn't have room to put it, but in the first few verses of this chapter, it describes Goliath's clothing in major detail. His size, the clothing, what it was made of, how weighty it was. And the Bible, when it does that, it doesn't describe clothing very often, but when it does, we're supposed to take notice. We're actually supposed to be like Israel and see, what are they so afraid of? Oh my word. This is why they're so afraid. We're supposed to feel the fear of Israel. But what's interesting about this is that Saul the king, the one who's actually described all through these chapters as the one who's head and shoulders above others, not as big as Goliath, is the one who's supposed to lead the charge. But instead, he is not only afraid, but he's causing the rest of Israel to be afraid with him. They're all scared. And you see this attitude of Saul's that's not one of a king who's, especially as David even calls, the armies of the living God. No. He doesn't act that way at all. In fact, he seems like he's protecting himself. He's kind of protecting himself from going out, and he's asking everyone else around him, who's going to go out there and take care of this? It's funny, one commentator put it this way: to the extent that Israel has been frightened by a giant, they run the risk of being corrupted by subscribing to that same ideology. See, their delusion is that height or mindless force is required as an answer to Goliath's challenge. It's kind of like when I was growing up and playing football in Texas, you start playing football very small in pads. They just bang you around and make you do things that maybe little kids probably shouldn't do. But I remember in middle school, one of our coaches was a former offensive lineman for SMU. He used to block for pro athletes. He was 6'5", weighed 265 pounds. He was enormous. And as a middle school kid, I'm teeny. You know, I weigh like 135 at most, okay? And I'm all gangly, and I can barely keep my pads up still. And I remember in a practice we're running that I was playing running back at the time. Running back, how fast can you be in that age? And you're like kind of like doing this through the hole, with the ball. And the ball's like bigger than you are. And I ran through the hole, and I ran past in scrimmage, and I was like, yeah, I came back. And he was playing, imagine this, the coach, this enormous man, was playing middle linebacker. And all he did was he put on one arm pad, and he just sat in the middle. And he would just, be the one that was kind of directing traffic. And I ran by him on this play. And so I decided I'd run by and say, hey, yeah, in your face, I ran by you. And I kind of got in his face and started talking it up. And he looked at me, and the other coach saw it, who was calling the plays. And I get in the huddle, and I'm feeling really good about myself until the coach goes, same play. And I'm like, are you kidding? Same play, I run, and I'm running, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I can do it, I'm going to get by him. I mean, he didn't even move, took one arm, smacked me across the face and the chest, and I was on the ground. I don't even know where the ball was. I don't even know where I was. I was knocked unconscious. I was like, oh, I couldn't breathe. This man was enormous. It didn't do anything. But all it took was for me to realize, when I got back to that huddle, and he said, same play, to realize how enormous this man really was and what I was up against. I realized how huge this man was. Why? Because I realized the fear behind it. You see, the courage here that's lacking, this false courage that Saul has, is self-protection motivated by fear. And this story here is not just one for war and battle. Courage is spoken throughout the Bible, not just in war, but in everyday life. And that's how it applies to you and me. Because what happens here is that when Saul and Israel are face to face with the deepest fear, the deepest nightmare that they can think of, they run. See, what courage is facing the deepest heart fear, the deepest heart nightmare that you have, and doing right in the face of it. Because what we tend to do is when we face an obstacle, when we face something like that, and not just a person, but a circumstance, what happens is that fear begins to dethrone God and devalue you. And that's what happens. What you start asking questions like, what will happen if I do this? Or, am I really this loved by God? Or, does this really matter in this situation at this time? You begin to start questioning things. You begin to dethrone God and say, oh, maybe He's not in that much control. And you begin to devalue yourself by making it all about this protection and putting yourself in circumstances that totally compromise and actually destroy you because of fear. C.S. Lewis puts it this way in Screwtape Letters. He says, "There is nothing like suspense and anxiety for barricading a human's mind against the enemy, that is God. He wants men to be concerned with what they do. Our business is to keep them thinking about what will happen to them." That book is all about how the devil works. And what Screwtape Letters are is the senior devil is speaking to a junior devil about how to attack us with fear. And what he does so beautifully is to attack us with the fear of what will happen to you if. That's what this is about. It's so interesting here what happens. No wonder they don't act in courage. It's all about self-protection. And you know what it means. You know what this is like. Because when you go out on this campus and you're faced in certain positions and you have to make certain choices and decisions, oftentimes you look at that scenario and go, what good would it do if I make this choice? Or how am I going to offend these people? Or how am I going to say no to this? I mean, let's just throw it out there. It's one of the most obvious ones, right? Drinking on campus. One of the most obvious things on campus about the drinking society is not so much that that's necessarily just going on, but how it's treated. It's the fact that there's so many times in pressure situations, whether it's on one side of people pressuring someone else to drink that you need to do this in order to be somebody, that there's a self-protection in order for that person to feel good about themselves drinking, and then on the other side of the fence, have the feeling the pressure that they should drink or be in this position and say yes because they can't say no. Well, think about it just in every day of not being able to say no to things. That takes courage to actually say no, to actually stop and not have to do everything. Because we're so good at saying yes to everything. We want to people please. We want everyone to like us. It takes courage not to please everybody. But what we do is self-protect, right? We protect ourselves from these things. Think about this. Saul and Israel are supposedly the armies of the Lord, right? They're the ones who have got this. They're the ones who are spiritual in our minds. But think about how we do this, if you're a person here that is a Christian, how we do this with our life in Jesus. We do it with what's called practical atheism. And oftentimes what that means is our faith and our life don't interact. That we may talk about these things, we may talk about being of God and a Christian and these kind of things, but when we're faced with certain situations, we throw out the window how it actually interacts with our real life. Courage means that there is an interaction. See, we tend to think that being a Christian, when I become a Christian, or if I become a Christian, that'll mean easy life for me. That'll mean I can sit back and take care of it. But what Saul is thinking is, no, what are we going to do? That's not what it means at all. It actually means we're called to step up and make hard decisions, hard choices, in hard places. And instead of thinking about the difficulty of the gospel, we oftentimes think about ourselves, aren't we? We're protecting us. We're willing to say, oh, I'll put that God thing aside. I'll put that aside in order to make this choice because I think I need this for me. But it does take courage to say no. It does take courage to step back and make a different choice. It does take courage to make choices that may be difficult. We like the easiness of it. It's interesting, too, that we didn't even get to read this, but there's a part in here where David is heard by his younger brother. I mean, actually, his older brother. Sorry. David comes to the fighting lines to say, hey, I'm here. What's going on? He starts talking about coming to fight this guy. And his older brother says, I can't believe you. I can't believe you're here talking this way. He even calls David evil for doing it. He says, you think you're such a big shot coming here to say you're going to fight Goliath. He throws guilt on David. And you know one of the interesting things about this is that the way that we interact with one another when we are tested in our courage, when we see that, and that's what Eliab, the older brother, is doing. He's throwing his guilt of not going to fight Goliath and his faith on and his shame onto David. Y'all, we operate out of guilt all the time. Instead of walking forth in courage, we walk forth in guilt. I guarantee you, we not only live in guilt, but we motivate each other by guilt. You know how it is. Someone comes up to you and says, oh yeah, thanks for doing this, you know? Or, I can't believe you did that. And, you know, they start throwing shame on you and shaming you about not doing something or not being somebody, right? And oftentimes what that comes from is that person feeling guilty about things in their own life. That's how we treat each other. We think guilt is the motivator. Guys, that is so destructive to you in your relationships. To motivate and to try and care for people out of guilt and shame, to constantly do that, what does that do? It's self-protection. You're trying to keep yourself at bay. This is Saul and Israel's courage. This is their self-protection. And just as deep as the issue on Goliath's side here. It's not just over here on this mountain. It's over here on this one. When Goliath comes down and his courage is different, it's not self-protection, it's self-promotion, right? He's promoting himself. He's lifting himself up. You know, there's this TV show that's been on, I don't know if it came on only once as far as I know, but you know, my bored TV watching, I don't know if it was at the end of summer or the beginning of the school year, but it was called Shaq Versus. And Shaquille O'Neal, this basketball player, yeah, I watch stupid shows, get used to hearing this. So he's, okay, this is so fascinating. Shaq, as you know, always thinks he's the greatest athlete on the face of the earth, okay? He really does. He sits there in the interviews and says this. And what he does in the show Shaq Versus is he challenges people. He challenged Ben Roethlisberger, the Super Bowl winning quarterback, to a football game to beat him as a quarterback. So Shaq, this huge gangly basketball player, is wanting to play against Ben Roethlisberger as a quarterback, throwing the ball and beating Ben Roethlisberger. And they have all this thing, and they get this, it's amazing. They have they go to the wherever it is, he issues a challenge to Ben Roethlisberger, and then he sets up like a media table and has like a press conference and starts talking all this trash to Ben Roethlisberger. And then he doesn't just do that. If you watch the Olympics, you remember Misty May Kerry Walsh, the volleyball winners, you know, the gold medalists. He challenged them to volleyball. He's talking trash to these ladies. He walks out onto the beach volleyball court and starts talking smack to them and issues a challenge to beat them. And then every time he gets totally shellacked, you know, it's just hilarious. That's what's so great about it. But that's kind of what we have. We have this enormous man who is somewhere between 9.5 feet tall and 7.5 feet tall. And he's coming out day after day from the armies of the Philistines to shout out and say, look, hey, we'll have a challenge here. You bring somebody out, and if you think they can beat me, then you win. If they beat me, then you win. But if I win, then we take over and we own you. And he's done this for 40 days now. And think about this. What is he doing? What does self-promotion do? The opposite of self-protection, and yet the same thing. It's lifting yourself up. Even self-protection, even though you're trying to guard yourself, you're still exalting you. That's what self-promotion does, but this is how self-promotion does it. It's a false sense of security to try and drive out fear, rejection, and pain. It's almost like being a complete stoic. Here's how it plays out practically. If you're the kind of person who has a terribly huge number of friends, but none of them are very deep, your relationships, you may be a self-promoter. Someone who has all these friendships, but there's never any sort of interaction of depth or pain or rejection or not feeling valued. If you have to keep it together constantly, you may be a self-promoter. If it's something where you feel kind of isolated a lot, maybe in groups when you're talking with people, you're one of those people that always has to say you have a better story. You always have to one up whoever's telling a story in a group or say you have one just like it or better. You may be a self-promoter. If you think that Christianity is great and all, but then prayer and church and those things are kind of a waste of time to you. Or if you think you can do it on your own, if you think you really... Self-promotion is just this mentality that I know I think of. It's like thinking you can put your head down and run through a wall if you run hard enough. And I know that you think that. You and I both believe if we work hard enough, we can do it. This message here is so misunderstood because we think this is all... See, the problem is this passage is always taught like, you believe it, you can achieve it. No way! That's what Goliath is promoting. That's who he is. In fact, the way he looks at David here in verse 42, that he looks down on him and despises him in weakness... You know, self-promotion is interesting. When he looks down on David and he sees David and he goes, it says he looks with disdain on him because he's handsome and ruddy and he's youthful and he starts jeering him. Here's my question for you. Self-promoters, like myself, what do you like around people who are awkward, who are weak, who are needy? Does it make you uncomfortable? Does it make you uncomfortable to be around people that may even be handicapped or not like you or poor? Because somewhere in you, it's hard for you to get past that there is a need, that there is vulnerability, and that it's not self-promotion. It's not you as the pinnacle of what everyone else should be like. And that's what Goliath is like. You know, I think Dwight Schrute from The Office said it best. When he said, I don't believe in coddling people. In the wild, there is no health care. In the wild, health care is, ow, I hurt my leg, I can't run, a lion eats me and I'm dead. Well, I'm not dead, I'm the lion. You're dead. Superior genes, I'm a Schrute. Superior brain power. Through concentration, I can raise and lower my cholesterol at will. But that's truly what we think it's like.
That's awesome.
You know what? It's not so much that we're just like Saul and Israel, or that we're, you and I are like Goliath. It's that we're both. We are over and over self-promoting or self-protecting. And they're so interwoven that we can't tell the difference. And the difference here is what's so different between David's courage and the other two is, first, look at this passage when he says here that he goes in the name. When he says to Goliath, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts." He's coming in a name. And what that means here is fascinating. Remember earlier I mentioned about how Goliath came out and issued a challenge. And that was very rare in the Old Testament, to have one person come out as a representative and say, "If I beat you, you will serve us. Your entire army will." But what David is doing here is becoming a representative. He's going in the name of God. He's not going in his own name. He goes in the name of the Lord. To bear a name, to carry a name like that, meant you were owned by that person. What David is saying is not, "I'm so brave." He's actually saying, "I'm going to go and fight Goliath not knowing what's going to happen to me." That's courage. You want to know what courage is? Courage is going out, stepping out and fighting and doing it, and yet not knowing what the consequences would be. And David does this, think of this, as a representative. To represent, to redeem, to, on account of the entire Israelite army, including the king himself, Saul, to go out and fight and even die as a representative for his entire group, for his people. You see what's happening here? He's a substitute. The one we would never think. Is becoming a substitute for the entire army. He's taking it on himself at the very beginning when he says, "Let no man's heart fall because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." He's saying, "Don't let your hearts be troubled. I will go as your substitute and fight. I will go as your representative." It's because we need a representative. Same representative that not only fought the giant here, but thousands of years later, who would fight as a weak servant and not just take up a sling, but take up a cross and would be our champion. Not in defeating just, you know, armies, or one person, but the defeating death itself. He is our representative. You want to know what true courage is? It means that you can live with freedom and fail even, and look in the face of hard choices that you have to make with courage, because you don't go in your name. When you go in your own name, when you go trying to represent yourself, it's either self-promotion or self-protection. But when you go in the representative you have, the one who, and it's amazing, it's not in strength, it's not in might, it's in weakness again that God promotes this. It's in the weakness of David. It's not in his strength. It's in his smallness, his obscurity, that this is even the first time we hear David speak, that he goes and he defeats Goliath. That's courage. That's how you can live life and face these challenges and face the reality, the fears, the nightmares that each of you has. And I know that every one of you can sit and ponder and think about what that is if something was taken away from you. But what gives you courage to face that, knowing that you have a representative that has taken all of it on, that, as Hebrews says, he sympathizes with our weaknesses, and yet he takes on the foe that we could never take, death. He takes even our sin on himself. That is the courage of the king. And that same courage is what you can have in this King. Let's pray. Father, I know that my heart is so prone to want to protect myself, to want to promote myself, because I really think that courage is up to me. I really believe that if I'm strong enough, or if I have these gifts, or if I take on this challenge, that I'm strong enough to handle it. And Lord, you know that I'm not. And you know that whatever the challenge is, whatever the person is, that everyone in this room cannot go to either one of those distances of promotion or protection. We must go in our representative. The one who took on sin and death. The one who knows us better than we know ourselves. Lord, give us courage. Give us courage not even knowing what will happen to us. Because we know that we have one that loves us more deeply. And has changed our lives more profoundly. And that name is Jesus. And we pray in Him. Amen.